you. I volunteered to initiate discussion about the younger generation, partly because liberals have been so critical of what they call Generation X, that it led me to believe that I probably would like these people. And certainly, I love my students. I'm going to compare survey generalizations about young Americans between the age of 20 and 35 with selected points in Russell Kirk's seminal discussion of conservatism's basic tenets, found in the opening pages of The Conservative Mind, which was published in 1953. Russell was in his mid-30s, not much older than the young people who concern us here, when he wrote that great manifesto. By what merit does the present younger generation earn the honor of being compared to Russell's fundamental principles? Initially, only the great merit of being disparaged by today's liberals. Now, because I don't attribute much validity to the idea of generation-specific attributes, I intend this juxtaposition not as an inquiry into the younger generation per se, but rather as a way of asking how flexible Russell's 1953 foundational principles are. To what extent the principles of conservatism can be seen in new ways? And what is the relationship between continuity and change in the ongoing life of conservative thought? First, a few caveats. I have only time to highlight certain points I find interesting in the generational attributes and in Russell's tenets, so this is not going to be a systematic comparison. Secondly, despite my skepticism about characterizing a whole generation, it's true that some age cohorts do go through certain experiences which their predecessors have not, and which may at least partially explain attributes about that age group that seem unique to it. In the case at hand, for example, most of the younger generation came to maturity in a country that faced no serious external threat. Indeed, in one that was enjoying a decades-long experience of economic expansion. They are the first generation of middle-class latchkey kids. The majority of them came home from school to an empty house. Finally, consider that by the age of 16, the average young person of this generation had seen 33,000 murders on television and in the movies. As for the principles of Russell's, which I will touch upon, I'm aware that I will be interpreting some of them differently from the way in which many of you have in mind. One of my main aims is to stir discussion about what these tenets really mean. But bear in mind, too, that since many questions besetting us today were not big issues in 1953, I'm not here speculating about how Russell would have applied his principles to our current problems. Still, good principles survive the test of time. The point of this exercise is to see whether the foundation he outlined 50 years ago can relate in a positive way to the attitudinal and behavioral patterns of young people his same age today, whom liberals label as conservative. Renewal means casting fresh, new, positive light on what we have received from the past. Russell did not want conservatism to stagnate. Can the younger generation renew the inheritance? Russell's list opens with the primacy of religious and moral order over human reason's artificial constructions. Material about the younger generation often mentions their desire for spiritual meaning. They belong in significant numbers to traditional religions. Though they also experiment with alternative ones, few find satisfaction for their yearnings in bizarre cults like those of the 60s. But perhaps a more concrete indicator of the priority they may be giving to morality over the forces of human reason is their seemingly inveterate need to infuse strong interpersonal dimensions and moral concern into professional and utilitarian relations which previous generations were willing to leave as impersonal, especially those in the workplace. The younger generation receives sharp criticism for requiring personal interaction, respect, personal participation in decision-making. They want to be taken seriously as persons, listened to, understood. Conservatives usually find such subjectivity dangerous. But alternatively, we might interpret these attitudes as a repudiation of instrumental social relations. Russell despised utilitarian and purely professional human relations, which he associated with modernization. His characterization of conservative then goes on to affirm an embrace of traditional life, at least in attitude. If it's too early to test their actual behavior, the younger generation appears to earn an A in this area. In survey after survey, they are determined to restore a stable family life to American society. One study found two-thirds of those interviewed resolving to spend more time with their kids than their parents had done with them. They do not need to strike out on their own and prove themselves independent as early as most of those in this room did. Indeed, they often live with their parents until their late 20s, and they unabashedly admit that they like their parents. They also strongly value friends. These salient traits of the younger generation, again gaining them liberals' disdain, call attention to an interesting and, to me, surprising omission in Russell's seminal review. That is, although we can infer the importance of the family and of intimate group life in his pages, these values do not receive explicit attention. Russell certainly never praised self-interested individualism, and his writings as a whole leave no doubt about the importance of the family. But the informal social dimension of the moral life, which some of us take as a hallmark of conservatism, does not appear as such in any of the basic tenets. One explanation may be that the young man had not yet spotted Annette on his screen. The high value today's younger generation places on primary social bonds, often combined with a preference for small-scale social organization, gets them into a lot of trouble with corporate managers, who complain of their unwillingness to sacrifice for the company. They are also accused of being reluctant to stand up and be counted. But think of what drew Russell to the Southern agrarians. I can imagine him approving of young people's refusal to take workaholics and self-righteous public figures as their role models, if this is what such criticisms are referring to. Russell goes on to highlight the importance of enjoying life, a value in itself. Here, too, the younger generation finds a congenial home in his principles. In virtually all reports about them, they describe the purpose of life as to be happy. And nothing assures one of the liberals' wrath more than that. Young people strongly value hanging out with their friends. They are not super achievers. Having fun with friends consistently ranks higher than the possession of a lot of things. Upon close examination, the materialist and consumer desires, which they do have, focus more on things which can provide intellectual, social, or cultural enjoyment, better stereos and wine, for example. They are not particularly interested in prestige items like expensive clothes and fancy cars. To me, this area comprises one of the most interesting findings in this little comparison. The simple desire to enjoy life partly explains why liberals accuse such people of lacking principles. They have no campaigns to launch, no great battles to fight. They might even be called politically naive. Critics charge that this is because they believe in nothing, and if this is true, it's a serious accusation. But it doesn't necessarily follow. Probably most Philadelphia Society members have found a cause in conservatism and the defense of the free market. But Russell's point seems to be asking, what's wrong with having no cause, just wanting to enjoy life? Our response may reveal something about ourselves. While Aristotle defined happiness in terms of virtue, I'm not aware that he thought fighting a cause was a necessary ingredient. In a related vein, the younger generation is criticized for indifference to careerism. Unlike many of the post-war generation, including conservatives, they aren't into climbing the corporate ladder. The best and brightest among them do not, on the whole, appear as ambitious as many in this room were at their age. They have no interest in a planned life trajectory to influence or success. Turning back to Russell, though, as I understand it, when he gave up his tenure-track position at Michigan State, he accepted a lifestyle of taking the substantive opportunities and challenges as they would arise, almost come what may. He called himself a bohemian Tory. Two of Russell's principles focus on the connection between property and freedom. I will not dwell on these, as on the whole, the younger generation seems in sync with him, though not, of course, at his depth. Indeed, many of them have an entrepreneurial flair. Socialism is dead. On the other hand, Russell's affirmation of a belief in orders and classes may point to an area of great disagreement between Kirkian conservatism and the younger generation. Namely, he refers to the domain of hierarchy and leadership, and we might add authority. The younger generation are not anti-authority in the sense that the 60s were. But observers consistently complain that, especially in the workplace, they show no respect for authority per se. And their survey responses confirm this. They do not accept the traditional criteria of age, formal qualifications, relative position in a hierarchy, experience, and knowledge as intrinsically carrying authority. Like people raised on a kibbutz, they are hypersensitive about what their peers think and feel, and they resent their superiors for not treating them as peers. They are criticized not only for not exerting leadership, but even for sanctioning those who try to. But they're not levelers. Rather, it seems to me that when it comes to what the rest of us find natural about authority, they just don't get it. The puzzling thing is that they're said to want to be told what to do on the job. Consider, for instance, the findings of a survey of young practicing Roman Catholics. On the one hand, church authority means little or nothing to them. One of them described the Pope as nothing but a paid elected official. Most said that conscience is the only moral guide. On the other hand, these same young Catholics are fiercely committed to such doctrines of faith associated with the church's authority as the Eucharist, the Trinity, and the Virgin, and the veneration of Mary. To most of my generation, these details comprise an anomaly. We take it for granted in a rather simplistic way that if you recognize what Russell called the great forces in heaven and earth, and if you're committed to family life, then you couldn't be indifferent to authority. But maybe young people growing up in a relatively safe and benign environment are pointing to a more nuanced understanding of authority. After all, in his foundational statement, Russell talks about hierarchy and orders and classes, but not about authority per se. And indeed, I would hardly describe Russell Kirk as having been deferential to authority. Maybe authority is more a concern of liberals than to us. Perhaps related to this discussion is liberals' bitterness that the young generation lack loyalty to the institutions to which they belong. To many of our generation, institutional loyalty is one of the main manifestations of loyalty. But consider what these words mean. I may be wrong, but I have a hard time thinking of any institution to which Russell Kirk was unwaveringly loyal. In a sense, doesn't his inspiring vision of the permanent things downplay man-made constructions like institutions? In these foundational pages, he highlights faith in prescription, but few institutions are prescribed. In the same paragraph, Russell warns conservatives against trust in sophisters and calculators, which I take to mean against all rationalists with an agenda. The younger generation is notoriously impatient of ideological claptrap. They have little tolerance for politicized social relations, political maneuvering, or clever arguments for public consumption. And they are hypersensitive to hypocrisy. We've already cited their indifference, even their antagonism, to causes and crusades. But perhaps more to the point is their guarded pessimism about their own and our society's future. Politicians, institutions, new theories and programs won't solve our own or the world's problems. One might even think they go too far in their mistrust of social change. For instance, in looking for a job, they place almost no value on whether it will enable them to help improve society. Let me close with a few comments. First, how durable and stimulating this exercise proves Russell Kirk's foundational statement to be. Secondly, if there are conservative tendencies in the younger generation, then what about the influence of formative generational experiences, since theirs differ from Russell's and ours in some quite traumatic ways? Third, to what avail is the younger generation's conservatism if they abjure an activist role in furthering and protecting it? Are they naive, irresponsible, or they just don't care? Alternatively, do we in the older generation derive too much of our conservative identity from fighting for the cause? Do we assume that renewal depends on our exerted effort to bring it about?